basically moving into a corner crack. And I know from experience it's not a good idea to go in the crack too much. Okay, I'm gonna get my left foot high onto a little notch. About belly height.
Delicate Hellcat at the crux on Hoy. Last word in day-long conversation with rock above deep blue, climbing into pale blue, aiming for grace. A hard way to be normal.
Yeah. Twist my left foot round on that notch. Bridging the crack a wee bit. I've got a yank on my right arm and haul my left foot up.
The gods of agility took him this far, 400 feet soloing and high on that mug's game. Now they desert him. His fingers stutter below the bulge. He's run out of ways to speak to sandstone. Gripped, mummified. I wrote that poem, Crux, about climbing the Old Man of Hoy, without ever having actually set hand or foot to it. Though I've spent a lot of time in Orkney for the last 25 years, and I've watched often enough with a kind of horrified fascination while climbers inched up it. Sitting now at the top of this cliff looking across at the Old Man is as near as I intend to get to it. Truth is, when I met a leading Scottish and Himalayan mountaineer in a pub in South Queensferry, I had climbed only in imagination, in some poems I had written. But Malduff didn't grasp the essentially metaphorical nature of poetry, and he assumed I knew what I wrote about, and in a fit of enthusiasm and alcohol, asked me to come with him on a full-scale expedition to attempt a second ascent of the Mustag Tower, the Himalayan Matterhorn, a snip at 24,000 feet. It changed my life. Led to three big Himalayan trips and half a dozen Scottish winters and a number of deep friendships. I didn't expect there would be much in common between a writer, even worse, a poet, and a bunch of hardcore mountaineers, but I quickly found there was an unexpected bond, an understanding, a kinship between the life artistic and the climbing life. We both understood what it was to arrange one's life around a passion that served little purpose, that earned little if any money, that was not done for audience or applause, but for the experience itself. It was done for a life more intensely lived, for the sake of getting higher. This mutuality has always interested me. I mean, what is the interplay between climbing and making art, and not just writing, but painting and sculpting? How does each activity feed the other, and what is it to incorporate both into one life?
I've always liked Hemingway's quote that there are only three sports. There's driving cars, bullfighting, and mountaineering. All the rest are just games.
During my crash course in winter mountaineering, Malduff took me to meet Rob Fairley, pal of his, who for many years has combined hard climbing, crofting, and dedicated painting, all done from a cottage hidden away among trees up a track near Loch Uig. Mal said I'd find him interesting, and I do.
I love this room. I've had a lot of nights here, usually with a glass of whiskey in those days when. It reminds me of, I don't know, the inside of a down-market little alehouse in Upper Nepal. It's wonderful. It's brown, essentially. Brown with the books, the artwork, various ancient ice axes. It's like the exteriorization of the interior of your head. One of the things that brought me here was going to your first exhibition. And that was the first time we met. And I remember it and thinking, by God, he is a good painter. The mountain ones, there's a lot of portraits, but the Munza Mountain, mostly Scottish hills, if I remember right, they were like, to me, hyper-realist, but with really odd, curious intrusions and things happening, coming into them, like these feathers you occasionally have where no feathers should be. It felt more like a state of mind than a place. What are you aiming at when you do, let's say, quotes, a landscape?
They will always come from something or a series of things that have happened. I mean, it could just be the exercise of getting into a particular place, which is actually, in some ways, that's the artwork. You know, in pure Richard Long fashion, you know, that's the artwork, and you're recording it by producing this piece of work. And an effort to try and describe what the land is.
To do that kind of painting of landscape, what land is, that's where the climbing connects, because you actually have to physically be in them to get that.
You have to be in the sweat, and in very, very many times, you know, you're in one of the world's thin places, and of course in the high Himalaya, very physically a very thin place.
Yes.
But I mean spiritually a thin place, you know, just, you know, where the corporeal meets the temporal. Technically it's quite interesting to paint in watercolour where the water's freezing before it's drying.
I'm thinking of other people that I talk to about climbing. Is it fair to say that I sense it's a way into the arts?
Again, if one was being pretentious, it's probably been more about, well, you could say trying to understand something about yourself, but you don't go out thinking, you know, I'll go and climb that route because I'm going to try and discover X, Y, and Z. But in the process of doing it, then yes, you do. You do discover something about yourself. And there is something quite glorious about, I mean, particularly on ice. If you're on your own and you know, you've just got your tools in the ice and your crampon points in the ice, and it's like flying. Even looking at it, you can see that, you know, the tool is, obviously it's gripping because you're moving up on it, but actually looking at it, you think, well, wow, how's that holding in there, you know?
Yes.
And it's glorious. Or, you know, if you're with a friend, you've got this sort of umbilical cord, this very bright umbilical cord, either running down into Spindrift, and when you hope he or she's still there.
Visually, I can see the pictures.
Running up. And that's all very enthralling.
I think of Rob as a man looking for a natural line. A natural line into a mountain, a line opening to his drawing hand or at the ice axe's tip. For Rob, it's more than just subject matter that links his climbing and his art. It's the inner experience. I think for him, climbing and mountains have perhaps become secondary, a means of getting into a position, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, to make the work. And it's an elevated position. He needs that. What form of life is it that upholds itself out of its element, to heights where sun burns and lungs heave, to thoughts unnatural and places inhospitable, to countless lives lost by accident or design? Are we climbing into life or out of it?
It's a bit damp. It's slimy underfoot. Okay. There's a big seam of quartz coming right down this crack. It's beautiful, but I know it's kind of quite loose in places. And I'm going to hop up with my right foot, using this ledge as a steady me. Push pull.
Climbers and artists are soloists, some more than others. They tend to value, even equate, their freedom and their solitude.
Opposite, right in front of us, on the Grand Floria, that mountain there, there's a party of climbers doing a climb that's called Asia, one of the sort of classic, interesting routes here. Always people on that this time of year.
Andy Parkin is not only one of the UK's greatest alpine climbers, but a unique artistic talent, painting and sculpting in the shadow of Europe's most breathtaking mountains.
Of course, they bring sheep up here now as well. And the sheep stay up there on the snow, funnily enough, to keep cool, because otherwise they're too hot up here, the sheep. And maybe they're just creatures of habit. Maybe no one else in Britain had heard about Chamonix, but the climbers had. There was a whole folklore attached to Chamonix, and it was an amazing revelation to see all this, actually, to realise there were mountains like this. You know, look at the Drew, for instance, as big as anything. And you've got some of the most evocative mountains in the Alps. I mean, for me, it's the Grand Jurass over there, or the Mont Blanc face of the Verte. You notice I don't mention Mont Blanc too much, which is by far the highest, but the least interesting view from here. It's just a snowy plod. I was always into art and looking at different forms of art, from cave paintings to German Expressionism to the Impressionists to Picasso. In all that studying and looking at paintings, I came across prints and paintings of here. from the 18th and 19th century. Now, they were wildly exaggerated with the spikes of these aiguilles. In the 1974, when I turned up here, hitchhiking from Switzerland, coming over the col there, I saw these mountains for the first time. I thought, yes, the painters didn't exaggerate so much. Above all with sculptures, they've got to be able to stand up. So there's a little element of engineering enters into them, really, as well. We're going around the studio now, but it's kind of rambling, this old building. So I'm sculpting and painting, doing exhibitions here. Upstairs is Peter, who steam bends wood and makes skis, right? There you've got like a big climber S, as I call her, not finished, but larger than life-size, climbing towards a point made out of like copper tubing. All the materials for sculpture are recycled, right? Copper, glass, crystals from the mountains. Things you collect, you know, things I'll end up transposing into sculptures.
It seems to me Andy's approach emphasises the instinctual and the ephemeral, working in the creative moment without any clear strategy or plan. Assembling the material that comes to hand, or climbing alone in some obscure new route above Chamonix, what he is doing is feeling the way.
The instinctual is the strongest form. It's what keeps me alive as a climber, for a start. And it's what gives rise to works of art too. I mean, I don't try and analyse until after the effect, because that will ruin any activity. Things just appear.
For Andy, his climbing and art practice can relate in some very practical ways.
Because I'm touching the lines here, feeling them, bending them, using finger strength to get what I want, just like in climbing. So there is that similarity. Working on much bigger sculptures, as much as 7 metres high that you can climb on. They're very tactile, those sculptures. So basically each time I'm working on it, I'm climbing on it, I'm up in the air, hanging on, working, enjoying the sensations of climbing and trying to put as much as that of that climbing truth into the piece of work. And knowing full well at that point, there aren't many sculptors on the planet that can do that. I'd say I'm, on the whole, I'm more successful as an artist than I am as a climber, because I've got more failures to my credit as a climber, because I've tried more obscure things, particularly in the stylistically extreme situations like being totally alone on something that's totally unclimbed, so no one knows about, least of all me. You could almost compare it to art, where you're trying something totally outlandish and you're not quite sure. Anyway, what you do in art, you risk marginalising yourself. So you might make money, you might not. You might be understood as an artist, you might not. Climbing, it's a bit similar, right? If you've got the statute of a mountain guide or something like that, then people take you seriously because it's got a diploma, it means you're making money. If you're not making money from something, it's suspect. So if you're climbing for yourself, like I do, I'm not mediatising it because I'm a private sort of person, you really suspect then. What is he up to, you know? In climbing, of course, what you'd risk, particularly soloing and pushing things, is like accidents and death, of course. And I've been, yes, in proximity of both of those quite a lot, actually, you know, all my life.
As I know myself, creating art and climbing involve extended and intense time alone, even if you're climbing with a partner. Andy Parkin strikes me as particularly adapted to solitude, with his marked preference for soloing, which is the most intense and most risky way to climb. But for Andy, both activities need that added dimension of exploration.
People have asked me, sort of, for instance, in climbing, why do you do these first ascents, like so many? And I've made a point in my life almost doing them, right? Is it because you can say that you're the first? I said, well, no, it isn't that at all, because sometimes you might not know. And being first guarantees you the sensation exploration of something private. That's the point. That's why people adventure. And the same in art as well. I can't produce stuff that I know is kind of a copy facsimile of something else, or without having gone through my own little filter system to make sure this is kind of me, I can justify doing it. Climbing as well has to be adventurous and new for me. Just not boring, not like everybody going up there. Like at the moment, there'll be loads of people in certain places in these mountains climbing because they're in vogue, or that's the place to go, or it's easy access or something. Says, well, That's the one place I'm definitely not going to go this summer. Definitely. And I've always liked that idea of the... that phrase... stay lean. Stay hungry. Because you're sharp like that. You're trying to go, you're trying to keep creating. You're not becoming complacent, right? And some people say I've got a fairly austere lifestyle, and maybe it is, but at the same time, it's... they're the conditions I need, you know, to function like I do.
As a counterbalance to all these ideas of solitude and soloing, some of my strongest memories of the Himalayas are very much shared with other people. This is an interlude on Mustag Tower. In these high places, we are melting out of all that made us rigid. Our ice screws hang loose on the fixed ropes to the col. We lounge in thermals on the glacier, brewing and shooting the breeze, that improbable project of conversation among the living. Laughter rings across the ice. Why not? None of us will die today. That's immortality. You can draw on in a cigarette, harsh and sweet, the way we like it. Rob is the climber artist of the ones we've talked to, most at ease with the idea of spiritual. The activity of creation that rises free from the personal ego into a pure expression of being.
You obviously don't climb in such a state of fear as me, that the sheer intensity of that experience, I did find it made the world extraordinarily present to me for periods at a time. My own physicality, the smell of snow, I remember these as being astoundingly intense experiences, the kind of intensity I had in childhood. Do you recognise that?
I think it's very, very true, actually. I think anybody who's climbed at any level at all has gone through periods of immense fear. I think it goes very much for the territory. And I think, actually, in some ways, that's the most... I'm not saying it's good to be frightened, but when you're climbing and you're climbing on something that is pushing your technical limits, it just requires complete concentration.
What the Buddhists call one-pointedness.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And that I very, very much recognise in painting. There are times when you have no idea where the last 4 hours have gone, and you realise that actually it's 2 o'clock in the morning. And where did that go?
Yeah, that's the most blessed time, isn't it?
It's really, it's really, really good. But it is that complete concentration on... stuff. So similarly, in climbing, you're on a really good day. It's as if you're watching.
You're witnessing.
You're witnessing.
Yes.
And I'm sure with writing, and certainly with drawing, you know, there are periods where actually your hand is, you've just been doing it for so long that it just does what part of your brain is thinking about.
I think that fits in this notion I had a long time that most of your brains are not in your head.
Dan Shipside strikes me as the most physical of these artist climbers. I mean, he foregrounds not epic mountains, but the immediate material under his hands and feet, the reality that lies inches from one's face when climbing or making visual art. Perhaps it's because he's made his home in Northern Ireland and not in the Alps that he brings climbing to its physicality, close up, balletic, at once brutal and delicate. With his interest in performance, video, sculptures one actually climbs on, the act of climbing itself has become the art.
The connection between climbing and art for me, well, it began quite early in my art career, if you like. I mean, I was climbing and becoming an artist at the same time, really. And at that stage, I was a painter, making quite kind of was a weird abstract paintings that started to recollect or meditate perhaps on what particular moves had been. So I might be climbing during the day and in the studio the next day and kind of thinking about a particular move that I did, and it might be from slapping one hand from one slope to the next, and this could almost be recreated in the painting in a kind of way, in a sense of balance, in a sense of compositions. And I think there's a high level of creativity in actually wanting to climb, because you're making problems for yourself. And very much in a way, that's what you do as an artist. You're trying to find ways to solve some kind of conundrum. And they become problems that need some kind of practical resolution to work through them. Same in climbing, you can maybe think what might work, but you can only do it by doing it. And I think in art, that's a really kind of interesting thing, because a lot of art can become very predictable in terms of the formulas you develop to make the art. And I think the more you kind of bring your art practice into the real world, the more you have to open it out to chance and to serendipity and to responding creatively to things as they happen and finding a richness in that.
As a writer of poetry, the idea of making things difficult for oneself and then looking for the elegant and unexpected solution is one I can very easily relate to.
Okay, we're coming down, just crouching down, just to come through this stone archway into this cove. It's on the inner shore in Peninsula in Donegal. Quite remote cove in some ways. And there are rock climbs on all these cliffs, more or less.
In one way, Dan's work is an inversion of the act of sculpting. Instead of taking the material and shaping it to his artistic will, he's letting the material shape him.
Okay, this is a traverse. Mignon kind of cracked edges. It's kind of a twisty move just there to bring my left foot behind my right and across. Okay, this section has got beautiful orange lichens on it. Little explosions in a Hollywood movie. Look, you've got to smear this bit. I think one of the things, that probably because of where I began climbing and my kind of climbing history, a lot of my climbing was in the Peak District and Lancashire, kind of gritstone boulders and crags. And I think that brings the scale much closer to kind of being less about the big view, more about what's right in front of you and what's close up. I guess the culture of mountaineering and rock climbing, it is a very visual world. And also in a lot of literature, it's about mountain landscapes with mountaineering and the kind of visualness, particularly probably spanning from the Alps and a Victorian era of Victorian painting, landscape painting, romantic, sublime, all those kind of things come from a kind of ocular position. Trying to talk to the gut, the stomach kind of area in terms of feeling, but nonetheless, it was all done through what you see or what it looks like. If you take all that away, what could landscape be? So you then start to kind of have possibilities of how the body is in landscape or in particular spaces or places, and a much more kind of embodied sense of what landscape is. And then from that, I kind of moved on to this idea of recreating the passage of movement rather than the look of the thing. So you're actually only replicating 5 or 6 moves over maybe a 2, 3, 4 meter section of whatever. So I was building these structures, which in one sense were sculptures, but in other senses were actually only a means to get to the artwork. So the artwork was actually the movement of somebody climbing these 4 or 5 moves. These works are quite brutal in that sense, that they purposely ignore what the thing looks like and purposely ignore the kind of richness, if you like, of the environment. But I think those moves then, for me, have the opportunity to be everything and anything. You know, that is a very rich world of kinesthetics, if you like. That's where the real kind of life of this climb is. It's in those moves.
I turn my wayward gaze to the ground beneath my boot. Thinking not of peaks, I loot them at every turning of the way. In here and now, no step is up or down. On in pain and hope and joy I go, until I love but do not linger on each footstep in the snow. That idea of distilling a climb down to its essential moves, and that becoming the art, brings back to mind that sense I get from Rob Fairley of The Line. The way that a climb can find its way through seemingly impossible terrain, or that a drawing all comes from one essential pen stroke, is just as true in how I find my way through writing a poem. And if climbing is more than a game, closer to a philosophy, a form of active prayer, a way to understand the world around us, this brings us to the heart of the mutuality between climbing and art.
Can climbing be a creative act? Creativity is a very awkward word, because I mean, if you say you've got a very creative accountant, it means something very, very different. And I'm not sure. I obviously think there are parallels. Strauss's Alpine Symphony. You know, there's an enormous connection through the arts of mountains, but they're always to do with much what we've touched on. They're much to do with what used to be referred to as the sublime. And I'm not sure that actually the physical act of going climbing is about that. It may promote that, but I'm not sure that mountaineering or climbing is creative in the same way that writing a poem or writing a novel or painting a picture or writing a piece of music is. Andy and I have argued this for quite a number of years now. He absolutely sees it as being, you know, he sees it very much as being a creative process. But he's a professional mountaineer.
Piece of art or climbing, it's about one thing for me, and it's experience, right? And that can be good, disastrous, everything. Definition, experience.
When so much contemporary art poses the question of, is this art? What sort of claim does climbing have to join the likes of performance or installation? Dan Shipsides.
I think you can make the case for climbing as art, but it will be constantly challenged by the whole communities of both art and climbing. I think that's kind of interesting, because that's often the same with making art. It's often challenged, is it art? The thing that art and climbing really have in common, I mean, it will sound very pretentious, but it's really to do with a creative engagement with life. When you boil it all down in terms of practice, in terms of why I do both, it's because I want to do it, I choose to do it. My life would be less without both.
For all three, Rob, Andy and Dan, climbing and art have gone in tandem from earliest days. And for all of them, there is a crossover, a cross-fertilisation, a leakage between the two activities that goes well beyond subject matter. There's an emphasis on the existential moment, the heightened experience, the engagement in the now, which lies at the heart of mountaineering and making art. They climb and make art for the same reason I write, to feel more alive, to know themselves and the world better. One is climbing into one's own ignorance of the next move, and that is what is so brilliant, scary, and addictive. It's about getting higher, deeper, further into the world and being in it, in this moment. Oh, and the theme music for our Mustang Tower expedition, played on little Walkman speakers at base camp or muttered under gasping breath as we leaned over our ice axes, was the Thompson Twins. It's a labour of love, so please don't...